When Marsha Brantley disappeared in late May or early June 2009, no one reported her missing for nearly 6 months, not even her husband. In past episodes, we've established what was going on in her life throughout the first part of the year, hearing from friends and family that she was depressed, dealing with financial crisis, and had stopped interacting with many people. Today, we'll track the timeline immediately following her disappearance, hearing from her neighbor as well as her hairdresser, the one who eventually reported Marsha as missing.
He told the most ridiculous story that Marsha had left him and had went out west. Well, why didn't she take her dogs? Well, she does not have a permanent address. So that just right then and there, I knew that was not true.
Welcome to Targeted, True Crime Podcast. We tell stories of those who were targeted by abuse and investigate cases of family violence using academic research to interpret the events. As a college professor, I think we need to stop making family violence a secret. It's time to tell our stories, use our experiences to help, heal, and provoke change. Targeted discusses sensitive information about abuse. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. While I can't find anyone who heard from Marsha after the end of May 2009, we don't know the exact day that she disappeared. It was likely the last couple days of May or the first days of June. As we know, Donnie didn't report Marsha as missing because he said she left him due to financial problems that he had brought up to her in those last days. You see, Donnie's business, a handyman franchise called House Doctors, wasn't doing well. They had had to pay nearly $100,000 for the franchise to begin with. And Donnie didn't seem to be able to make it work. This was a time of the housing crisis in the United States, though, so home repair was not the growing business it had been a few years before. Marsha talks a bit about financial difficulty in her blog, but I think you'll notice some of the minimizing she does. It's not clear how deep their financial problems were.
Donnie and I have been tightening the belt this year in an effort to save money and be environmentally responsible. In addition to driving less, we're eating out less and trying to find things at home or closer to home to keep ourselves entertained. This weekend, we simply pulled some chairs out and sat in the driveway like the Beverly Hillbillies while the dogs played and chased each other. The mosquito candle kept the bugs at bay until well after dark. We watched much less TV and enjoyed each other's company. It sort of reminded me how folks did things way back in the day when neighbors knew each other and spent time visiting on the porch. We discussed turning off the cable or at least going back to basic cable since reading and talking is much more productive anyway. I draw the line, however, at doing without my internet.
On June 2nd, 2009, Donnie went to the local Home Depot and bought a benzomatic torch kit at around 2 in the afternoon. This is a burning tool with a little propane tank and a trigger so that the flame can adjust to burn in any direction. He spent $32.19. Around 8 p.m. that same day, he went to Walmart and purchased a few more goodies. He spent $44.72 on a drop cloth, Gorilla tape, Lysol, paper towels, and poly sheeting, along with Pop-Tarts, breakfast cereals, and bananas. Because, you know, he might need a good breakfast that next day to start his day out right, so he could do all of the work that he had to do from his non-functioning handyman business, which he had just bought supplies for, but didn't seem to have any jobs that he was set to do. That next day, he went to Lowe's, another home improvement store, and bought a 16-inch chainsaw made by Oregon. Sometime in that first week or two of June, he also went to a landfill and dumped quite a few things, getting a very helpful receipt so that police would discover this later. On June 8, 2009, Donnie went into a local rental company, paying $72.44 for a 3,000 PSI high-powered pressure washer. Again, as far as we know, he had no job scheduled that he needed a pressure washer for. Meanwhile, people were noticing that something was wrong and that they weren't seeing Marcia, but none suspected anything sinister at first. You heard from two of Marcia's friends last week, and next we'll hear from a neighbor who noticed a change at Marcia's house, as well as Marcia's hairdresser. Weeks went by. Neighbors wondered why the dogs were barking all the time and why Donnie was walking them at 5 a.m. It was almost as if he was avoiding them. I spoke with one of her neighbors to try to get a better idea of what the neighbors were thinking. I first asked her to tell me how she knew Marcia.
My name's Suzanne, and I actually lived a couple of houses down the street from her. And I've come across her because she walked the neighborhood and I walked the neighborhood. We'd speak. Sometimes it was just a wave and she'd go by. Other times she would stop and just chit-chat about her dogs if she was walking her dogs or talk about the neighborhood in general.
I asked Suzanne if she had ever seen Donnie and Marcia walking the dogs together.
I don't recall ever seeing them walk together. Maybe occasionally, but not. It wasn't like an all-the-time thing. I remember more of seeing her by herself a lot.
Suzanne really didn't see Donnie ever walking the dogs until after Marcia was no longer around.
After we didn't see her anymore, I was one of those people that get up early. I would walk the neighborhood between 5 and 6 a.m. That's when I would see him walk the dogs. I just remember passing him because the first few times that I ran up on him, it kind of startled me because I don't see people out that early because I'm usually the only one out. And it would startle me to see somebody out in the dark. And then when I figured out it was him, I didn't feel fearful at that point. I didn't know, you know. But that was after she had already disappeared. He would walk them in the dark. I never saw him walk them in the daylight.
Suzanne was surprised that only Donnie was walking the dogs, and she also noticed other things. I asked at what point she realized that she wasn't seeing Marcia anymore.
I don't know, because we always saw her, and then we would see her come by in her car, because she drove that little black sports car. We would see her come by in her car, and I think we realized, oh, you know, what's happened to Marcia? You know, are they separated or divorced? And I remember asking a neighbor that actually lives closer, and they said, oh, yeah, and he said they were separated. So then we probably didn't think anything else about it. We thought she left.
I asked if there was talk in the neighborhood.
Neighbors talked, and we kind of were out walking, and you see a neighbor out. You'd say, hey, what's happened to so-and-so or whatever? I just remember that discussion happening. They said, well, you know, she left, her car's gone, and maybe it got repossessed at that point. Someone had in the neighborhood that said what they think it had gotten repossessed. And I'm like, well, why did she leave without her car? There was kind of some discussions on, well, why would she leave without her dog? Because they were her dogs. So we all had those conversations, but at the time we weren't thinking anything other than, oh, she left, but she left her dogs.
Months went by. The yard at the house, once lovingly maintained by Marcia, now lay untouched. Unmowed lawn, dead flowers, weeds, scraggly bushes. Some neighbors wondered what was happening.
The yard had quit being mowed, and she had always kind of groomed the flower beds and hung up flowers. And it just kind of like, you know, when you feel like there's just a bachelor that lives there, kind of how it looked, because it wasn't groomed anymore. And you could kind of tell that something was going on, that, and you assume that, yeah, there's a divorce because the way that the yard's looking.
One day, a different neighbor, Phyllis, finally marched up to the house and demanded to know where Marcia was. Donnie told her that Marcia was leaving him and went out west. The neighbor, Phyllis, didn't believe him, but didn't know what to do. She ended up taking the information to the most helpful of places, the beauty salon. Marcia Brantley regularly had her hair done by hairstylist Kelly DeLude, who is an easygoing, cheerful, sympathetic kind of woman who inspires people to talk with her. You may have seen Kelly in the 48 Hours episode on Marcia Brantley's disappearance. It was Kelly who became the one who reported Marcia as missing. Never, never underestimate the clout of your local stylists and their ability to gather puzzle pieces from seemingly unconnected people. Because they listen to their clients all day, every day, they have snippets of information, and when they join them together, great things can come about. As an aside here, I have to give a shout out to my local salon because they helped me connect with a number of people I've interviewed for this podcast. To my salon, I love you, and you are the best. Back to Marcia's story. Marcia's neighbor Phyllis had her own business near Kelly's hair salon, and she would pop in to chat with hairstylist Kelly. Here's a snippet from an interview that I did with Kelly.
Her name is Phyllis Dodd, and she's a lovely lady. She had a massage therapy business a few doors down from the salon. We knew one another through that, so I had known Phyllis. And she came over, you know, all she had to do is walk a few doors down and just ask me, you know, have you seen Marcia lately?
Then neighbor Phyllis told Kelly about the condition of Marcia's yard.
One thing that, you know, stood out to her neighbor when she came to me and was telling me that something seemed, you know, amiss was that the flowers in her yard were untended and that her dogs were barking their heads off at the house and not being walked. That was something she was meticulous about. She always kept her yard very nice. She tended her flower garden and took great pride in that. And to see it in disarray, she, you would know something was not right. And then, of course, you know, she walked her dogs every morning, walked them with this lady. They walked dogs together in the morning. So that was another thing that stood out outside of her routine. Then we were just really, really concerned about her. And the more we spoke with each other, the more concerned we became. After she talked to me, I tried to call her. So I either called her phone and got a voicemail or it was disconnected. I kind of think it was disconnected. So then I tried to call her husband. Again, I don't remember if I got a voicemail or it was disconnected yet. Later on, I definitely tried to call it and it was disconnected, the number for house doctors. So that seemed strange to me. And we just sort of would go back and forth. And then my neighbor, he worked for Donnie at House Doctors, and I saw him out one day, and I asked him about it, and he said that Donnie had just closed up the business. He went into work. It was closed up, no word, and he was having a hard time getting his tax W-2s from him. Again, you know, I thought that's really weird. Phyllis and I would report these things back and forth to one another, and finally Phyllis knocked on his door. You know, if she had not been bold enough to do that, I don't think that all this would have came out. She knocked on his door, and he told her the most ridiculous story, that Marcia had left him and had went out west. And Phyllis said, well, why didn't she take her dogs? Well, she does not have a permanent address. That just right then and there, I knew that was not true.
Kelly thought back to when she had last seen Marcia in the spring of 2009. Usually, Marcia had both a haircut and blonde highlights done, but had decided to skip the haircut that time.
The last time that I did her hair, and I think it was in April of 2009, we had always cut her hair quite short, and she had decided to grow it out. The last time I did her hair, she said, you know, I don't think I'm going to cut it today. You know, we had colored it, and I'm going to let it grow because Donnie said he likes it better long. The reports that she left him and things of that nature. You know, I've never met a woman, and I've said this before, when she decides to leave her husband, cares how he likes her hair. And that might seem silly to other people, but I would think anyone listening that's a woman would think, you know, yeah, that's right. You know, if I was going to leave my husband, I wouldn't care if he liked my hair long. I would have it cut however I wanted.
As Kelly thought about Marcia's decision not to cut her hair in order to please Donnie, and then paired that with Marcia's absence and with Phyllis's strange reports of Marcia's house and yard.
I thought back to her saying, Donnie likes my hair better long. I think I'm going to leave it. You know, it just didn't sound right. So along with her not answering her phone, which there would be no reason for her not to do that, and him closing up the business strangely all of a sudden like that. So I called the police department, and whoever answered, you know, a nice gentleman, I have nothing against him. You know, it was a strange call to get. And I said, you know, I've got a strange story to tell you, but, you know, bear with me. And I told him, and he said, I'm sorry. And who are you again? Are you her sister, her mother? And I said, no, actually, I'm her hairdresser. You know, I'm sure he thought that this sounds ridiculous. But he said, well, ma'am, if she left him, she left him. I mean, unless you smell a smell or, you know, you've seen a body, there's not really anything that we can do. And I understood. And I said, okay, well, thank you. I think it was probably around August, September, or something like that. I thought, at this point, I'm just going to have to leave it up to the Lord. And I prayed about it, which I had been praying about it, for wisdom, and I just sort of let it go.
While Kelly had reported it, it wasn't taken very seriously. Kelly brought it up with one of her customers, an attorney in town, who had a solid relationship with law enforcement. Let's listen to Kelly describe what happened.
I think it was around possibly October that Jerry Hoffer came in to get a haircut. He's an attorney, a family law attorney here in town, and I'd done his hair for many years as well, and our daughters grew up in school together, and we knew one another very well, and I had him sort of captive there in the chair, so it just occurred to me, you know, maybe he can do something, or know of something maybe that could be done. I could have told that story to several other attorneys or people, and they would have said, well, you know, that's a very interesting story, you know, and could you raise the sideburns up maybe a little more, you know, and just be dismissive. But he believed me. I said, what do you think about that? And he said, well, I think he killed her. I said, I do too, but I guess there's nothing we can do. And he said, oh, yes, there is. We can order what's called a welfare check. He left out of there and immediately went and got that going.
Attorney Jerry Hoffer listened to her and intuited that this wasn't loose gossip. Kelly isn't one to speak ill of others, as far as I can ascertain. So I think her even gently raising this concern was a red flag for him. Hoffer had a good relationship with the district attorney's office, and he spoke directly with District Attorney General Steve Bebb.
And then Walt Hunt, a detective with the DA's office, was there that weekend and called me. I answered the telephone, and he introduced himself, and he said, I think he's killed her. It was a very interesting interview he had with Mr. Brantley.
I probed to see what Kelly remembered. She was a bit hesitant, but described the following.
You know, I just remember Mr. Hunt saying to me, you know, I've never seen anyone react the way he did. He said, normally if I knock on your door and say, you know, I'm a detective with the DA's office, and I'm here looking for your wife. There's been a report. You're going to be nervous, apprehensive. He was none of that. He said he just was calm and almost as if he expected me. And that just struck him very odd. From that point on, it just sort of steamrolled, and the TBI got involved.
Now we are in November of 2009. 6 months after anyone communicated with Marcia Rader Brantley. The DA called in the TBI, that's the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, to work the case. Later, the Bradley County Sheriff's Office became involved, and we'll hear from the former Captain Jimmy Woody in another episode. While law enforcement now flagged Marcia's disappearance as suspicious, there was limited evidence or leads. They suspected Donnie Brantley, Marcia's husband, but had no direct evidence that tied him to Marcia's disappearance. They did have plenty of circumstantial evidence, though, which we'll discuss more in a future episode. Join us as we continue to bring attention to Marcia Rader Brantley's disappearance. Next week, we are going to start to build our victim profile of Marcia so that you'll better understand how a woman who is often described as kind, caring, fun, private, driven, and reserved, became disconnected enough from her friends and family that they didn't understand to report when she was missing. Join us as we remember Marcia. Since it is a few days before Christmas when this episode releases, I want to share with you a post that Marcia wrote during her last Christmas season. And let me also answer one of the questions people have been emailing me about. They're wondering if I found recordings of Marcia reading her blog. I wish. But no. I asked Andy Elizabeth to read them for us. Andy was a vocal performance and advertising major at the same school where Marcia attended and later spent most of her professional career. Marcia worked in student life and was devoted to mentoring students at Lee College. I think Marcia would have approved of Andy providing a voice for her. Incidentally, her website is listed in the show notes if you would like to book her. She's available. She's also a classically trained singer and has the voice of an angel.
December 26th, 2008. The day after. It's the day after Christmas, and the sky has finally turned from Smith and Wesson gray to more like dolphin silver. Not quite sunny, but better than it was a few hours ago. The dogs are staring at me, which means it's time to go for a walk. Donnie's about to jump on the bike and go for a soppy bike ride, for hours no doubt, and I'm determined to walk until I shave at least a pound off this post-Christmas carcass. How are you feeling? Were you strong enough to say no to several extra helpings of the casserole, butter, slathered rolls, gravy, and dessert? Not me. Nope, I ate it all. Several times. So, here I go with my tennis shoes on, determined to walk until my blistered feet cry uncle. Wish me luck.
I pray that each of you have a special holiday season, filled with love, even if COVID adds a layer of worry, stress, and isolation as we try to protect our families. I know mine will be quiet this year, with just a few of us. My daughter and I have been quarantining after my surgery, so it's unlikely that we'll bring the disease to my wonderful parents and son. My other sweet daughter will stay far away and celebrate with her roommate because long-distance travel is so dangerous right now. We already lost my brother this year, which was devastating, and I'm determined to do all we can to avoid more death in the family. I imagine that many of you have been impacted this year as well. I pray for blessings for you in the new year. And I pray for peace, my friends. Peace. Thanks so much for joining us at Targeted True Crime Podcast. If you're interested in my sources or research, I include a bibliography on my website, www.targetedpodcast.com. If you want to support the show, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and writing a sentence or two about what you like. If you want to connect on social media, I'll include links in the show notes. If you'd like to reach me via email, you can do that at targetedpodcast@gmail.com. Please stay tuned for promos at the end of the podcast and check them out if they sound interesting. As we end, let me emphasize that if you or someone you know is a survivor of domestic violence, you are not alone. There are resources available to you. I've included some contact information in the show notes and on the website about a few organizations. Leaving an abusive relationship can be one of the most dangerous times for a target, so I strongly encourage you to reach out for support. Getting help may be the hardest thing you'll ever do, but it will be worth it. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. Peace, my friends. Peace.
My name is Paige, and I'm the host of Reverie True Crime. Reverie means to daydream, but even daydreams can turn into nightmares. Join me as I tell you haunting and horrific reveries about missing people and senseless murders. I also interview survivors and people seeking justice for themselves or a loved one. New episodes come out every Monday morning, and sometimes you'll get bonus episodes on Thursdays. Wherever you're listening to this current podcast right now, you can find Reverie True Crime.